Well, hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us to kick off the inaugural 2015 broadcast season of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. We are here once again in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room, a radio out of the past. And this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast on this day, January 3rd, 2015, Saturday. So folks, yep, we're back off of our little hiatus, and we are kicking off the 2015 broadcast season with a fan favorite here at MSS. And what better way? It's January, winter is in full swing. So we're going to have Rotten Rick Spurgeon kick off the new season here. He knows a thing or two about the cold, so why don't we just sit back, grab our drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Rotten Rick, the microphone is yours.
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go.
Good morning, kiddies.
That's when I think of you. When shadows fall at the close of the day, I turn on the switch and it starts into play.
Hi everybody, welcome into Michael's Saturday Surprise for the first offering of 2015. And Michael decided, let's start with the worst guy first, and then things can only improve as they go on. So, thus I am here. Tonight I thought we'd have kind of a grab bag. One of my favorite pastimes is just turning on the radio, fiddling with the Philco, and seeing what comes up. And what came up are three programs, which I think you'll find interesting. Remember back in listening to radio that quite often the sponsor was pretty closely identified with the program. Jack Benny had Jell-O and Lucky Strike, Lone Ranger and Cheerios. It goes on and on. I could give you 25 or 30, but the point's there. Well, this company decided to take it one step further, and they identified their character with the sponsor. This is an interesting program, although the quality may not be that great in terms of its content, but I think maybe one of the first, maybe even the first, female detective on radio. 1936, it wasn't a very popular venue. In fact, it never got to be that popular, really. As you know, the females as they existed were pretty well outnumbered by a horde of Sam Spades and Dick Tracys and it goes on and on. So here's one of the original female type. In this case, just to make sure you don't forget the sponsor, well, the name of the character was Phil Coe. Now, who do you think would possibly sponsor Phyllis Coe? You're about to find out.
Ladies and gentlemen, quiet, please. A murder has been committed.
Here's your chance to play detective. Philco Mysteries on the air. The new, exciting, thrilling, chilling radio contest that pays you huge cash prizes for having fun. Every week at this same time over this station, your Philco radio tube dealer brings you transcribed the Philco Mystery Contest. $50,000 in cash for the winners. $50,000 in cash for solving simple mysteries. Weekly prizes, big grand prizes, a real contest of skill. Anybody can enter, nothing to buy, and you may win. All you need is the free Philco mystery book your Philco tube dealer will give you. Tells you all the amazing details, shows you how easily you can win, lists all the prizes, contains free entry blanks. You cannot win without this book. Get your free copy right away. Already? Got your thinking caps on? Then here goes Philco mystery number one. Listen carefully. Keep your wits about you. Better have pencil and paper handy. Jot things down in your Philco mystery book, of course, if you already have it. And if you haven't, be sure you get it as soon as possible. Phyllis Coe, her friends call her Phil Coe, the beautiful girl detective, daughter of the late Philip Coe, world-famous criminologist, is going to solve a mystery right before your ears. And then you are going to show how she solved it. Come on, let's play detective. Your first case is the case of the dead magician. Up there on the stage of the Regal Variety Theater, the great Umberto is just completing his clever manipulation of a pack of cards. The trick the magician is doing now is all the more amazing because Umberto is wearing a pair of gloves. Ah, there it is. Using only one hand, with a lightning-quick gesture, he has fanned the whole pack out like a peacock's tail. It's a beautiful trick, and the audience appreciates Umberto's skill as well they should. He takes a bow, and now he's taking off the gloves. He walks over to the wings, and with studied carelessness, he tosses the gloves to someone waiting off stage. And now he's back in the center of the stage to make an announcement. The great Umberto.
Thank you, my friends. Thank you. And now comes my most remarkable achievement. The illusion which has made me famous in 37 countries of the world. It gives me particular pride to perform my illusion this evening because seated here before me in the front row is Miss Phyllis Coe, the daughter of that world-famous criminologist, the late Philip Coe. And seated beside this charming lady is the well-known mystery novelist, Mr. Thomas Taylor. And now for my amazing illusion. A human being, a man or a woman from this audience, will seat himself upon this chair here on the stage. I will stand in front of this person with my back to the audience and have the lights put out for the merest instant. When the lights are again put on, the person will have disappeared. Now, who will be so kind as to come up here to the stage to assist me? Please, please, someone, anyone. There is no danger.
Me?
This young lady here.
Well, I do, mister.
Perfectly, my dear. Come up these little steps, please. Allow me.
Thanks.
Now, you will kindly be seated upon this chair.
All right. Now, what do I do?
You do nothing. It is I who will do.
Oh.
So, ladies and gentlemen, the young lady is seated. And now I stand in front of the young lady with my back to the audience. So, are you ready, my dear?
Okay, go ahead.
Now, I will count three slowly. On the count of three, please flash all the lights off. And then on again instantly.
Yes, sir.
And now, I begin to count. One, two, three.
Will everyone please remain seated?
Look, Umberto is dead!
Quiet, please. Quiet, everybody, quiet.
No, that magician's been murdered.
We don't know whether he's been murdered or not, madam, but he has been shot. Now, can all of you ushers and stagehands hear me?
Yes.
My name is Phyllis Coe. I'm a criminologist, an amateur, but still I've had experience with these cases. I want you ushers and stagehands to guard all the exits.
All right.
Don't let anyone leave the theater. One of you, please go out and get the police.
Okay, I will.
Now, is there a doctor in the audience?
Yes, Miss Coe, I'm a doctor.
Oh, please come up here and examine this man.
Of course, immediately.
Phil.
What, Tom?
You sure you want to get mixed up in this?
Of course I do. It's my duty.
Well, I might get another novel out of this, but don't do anything rash.
Well, don't worry. Well, Doctor, what about it?
This man is dead. The bullet entered his chest on the right side. Who could have done it, Miss Cole?
Entered the front of the body on the right side. Well, that girl could have done it. She was rather close to the magician, you'll remember.
The girl? Of course, it must have been the girl. But where is she?
She must have run away. You over there! Are you one of the stagehands?
Yes, ma'am. I'm Eddie Daniels, the property man.
All right, Eddie. Stand by, will you please?
Sure.
I may want to ask you a few questions.
Yes, ma'am.
Tom.
Yes, Phil.
Right after the shot, I heard a gun thrown on the stage. Will you look for it, please?
Sure.
It's probably under that black curtain at the back of the stage.
Yep, you're right. It is here. Shall I pick it up?
Yes, but do it with a handkerchief and examine the gun for fingerprints.
Righto.
Doctor, have you found anything of interest?
Not much, Miss Cole. As I told you, the bullet entered the right side of his chest.
Yes.
And there are no powder marks or burns on the dress shirt or coat.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Oh, this is simply awful.
Oh, please, please, you'll have to be quiet, miss.
I'm not a miss, I'm a widow. I'm Mrs. R.J. Brown.
Well, Mrs. Brown, I must ask you to be quiet.
How can I be quiet? Oh,
Phil, look out!
Oh!
Boy, that was close.
You're telling me.
I'll say it was close, Miss Cole. That sandbag fell all the way down from the fly loft over the stage.
Where are the ropes that control these sandbags?
They're backstage. Come on back and I'll show you.
All right. Lead the way, please.
I'm tagging along, Phil.
All right, Tom.
Well, Miss Cole, here are the ropes.
I see. And here's the one that dropped the sandbag after it was loosened.
Well, whoever did it must be backstage here somewhere.
Who's back here? You may as well come out and show yourself.
All right. Line up the three of
you. Look out, Tommy has a gun.
I'll drill the first one of you that moves. Get me?
Cut it out, Sam.
Shut up, Eddie. This is my business.
Eddie, do you know this man?
Why, sure. It's Sam Bolivar. He plays a trombone in the orchestra. Okay, Sam, hand over that gun.
No, you don't. Get away, Eddie.
Eddie!
Now, don't worry, Miss Cole. That gun's loaded with blanks for one of the dramatic sketches on this week's bill. Sam must have swiped it out of my property room here. One move out of you, Sam, and I'll slug you.
Let's all go into your property room, Eddie.
Yeah, sure, Miss Cole.
All right, Sam, you first.
Okay, I'm going.
You come in too, Eddie.
Yeah, sure.
And you, Tom.
And how?
Now, Sam, why did you drop that sandbag?
Well, I wanted to scare you out of the theater.
Why? Did you shoot Umberto?
What if I did?
Did you or didn't you?
Yeah, I shot him, the dirty skunk. He deserved worse than that. Shooting was too good for him.
Never mind that. Where were you standing when you shot him?
Right behind him, down in the orchestra pit.
I see. And then you threw the gun up on the stage?
Yeah. Then I ducked out under the stage, through the door in the orchestra pit.
Tom, are there many fingerprints on the murder gun?
Matter of fact, darling, there don't seem to be any. The murderer probably wore gloves.
Thanks. Now, Eddie,
yeah?
I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Sure.
You were backstage when the shooting occurred, so you might be able to help us clear up a few points.
Okay, Miss Cole.
What's the use of wasting any more time? I told you I shot the guy, didn't I?
Yes, but I still want to talk to Eddie. Now, Eddie, you said you're the property man, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Just what are your duties?
Well, it's my job to take care of the props. You know, anything that an actor handles on stage is called a prop. It may be a pack of cigarettes, a cane, a bunch of flowers, or anything. For instance, those gloves that Umberto threw to me.
I see. Where were you when Umberto was shot?
I was in the wings. I was waiting to take that chair off after his act.
You were there when the lights went out?
Yes, ma'am. I heard Umberto count three, and then the shot was fired.
I see. All right, Eddie, thank
you. Let me go! I didn't do it! I tell you, I didn't do it! Let me go!
That's what you say.
Hey, Captain, bring that girl in here, will you?
Okay, come on, you.
I didn't do it! Let me go! I didn't do it!
I found this girl running down 13th Street with a stage doorman chasing her. So I nabbed her and brought her back in.
Thanks, officer. Go out on the stage, will you? You might be able to help.
Okay.
Sam, what are you doing here?
Well, Glenda, I shot Umberto, and they caught me.
Oh, no, Sam, you didn't do it. You didn't!
Now, wait a minute, Glenda. How do you know Sam?
Well, he's my boyfriend. We're going to be married. But he didn't do it. I did it. I shot Umberto.
Glenda. Glenda, what are you saying?
Mother.
Mrs. Brown.
I heard what she just said. But she didn't do it, I tell you.
I did shoot him, Mom. I did, oh, I did.
They're both crazy, Miss Cole. I told you I did it. Ain't that enough?
Well, this is the craziest murder I ever heard of. Everybody wants to go to jail.
Be quiet, Tom.
Yes, dear.
Now, Mrs. Brown.
I tell you, my daughter didn't do it. I shot Umberto.
Why?
Because 3 years ago I had another daughter. Glenda's younger sister. She met Umberto and fell in love with him. And one night they ran away together and got married. Then I began to get letters from my baby. Heartbreaking letters. She said that her husband mistreated her, beat her terribly. Several months later, they sent her back to me. She'd taken poison. I swore then that I'd get the man who killed my baby, and now I've had my revenge. That man's dead, and I killed him. I was sitting in the front row, and when the lights went out, I shot him and threw the gun up on the stage.
I was sitting in the audience, too, Mrs. Brown. But I didn't see any flash when the shot was fired.
Of course you didn't. I tell you, I shot him because of what he did to my sister. I held the gun right against his chest, and I fired.
You did not, Glenda.
Sam, I tell you, I did.
You women are both lying to save each other.
And Sam, you're lying to save Glenda. Oh, why don't you children stop it? I shot that beast, and I'm ready to take the consequences.
Mrs. Brown, there are no fingerprints on the gun.
Well, I wrapped the handkerchief around the gun, yes. Yes, that's what I did.
You see, Miss Cole, you can see that my mother's lying. I did it, I tell you. I did it.
Now, wait. Be quiet, all of you. Tom.
Yes, Phil.
Since you're holding the murder gun in your hand, I suggest you aim it at Eddie Daniels, the property man.
Huh? It's loaded, you know.
Of course. And if Eddie makes a move, you'd better pull the trigger.
Hey, wait a minute. What's the idea?
My friends, Eddie Daniels is the only one in this room who could possibly have killed Umberto. Are you going to tell us about it, Eddie?
Yes, ma'am. I guess I might as well. Now that I look back on what I've said during the past 10 minutes, I can see that I made enough mistakes to hang an army. Yeah, I stood in the wings and shot that rat Umberto and chucked the gun out toward those curtains on the stage. Umberto seemed to have a way with young girls, and Like Mrs. Brown here, I once had a daughter, too. Well, come on. What are we waiting for?
So, Eddie Daniels, the property man, murdered the great Umberto. And you have just heard Phil Coe, the famous girl detective, find the murderer. Of course, you know how Phil Coe found it out. You heard everything that happened. You know everything Phil knew. It ought to be very simple for you to point out why Phil Coe suspected Eddie. Can you? How good a detective are you? $50,000 in cash prizes are waiting for the best detectives among you listeners to this program. Over 2,000 weekly prizes and 51 huge grand prizes in the great Phil Coe Mystery Contest. It's all fully explained with fascinating diagrams and full details in the Phil Coe Mystery Book, which your Philco tube dealer will give you free. If you haven't yours already, get it just as soon as you can. Then you can enter this easy contest that pays big cash rewards. There never was a simpler, easier, more exciting contest. Nothing to buy. Anybody can enter. This is a real contest of skill. Conciseness, clearness, neatness, and good common sense are the only things that count. Enter the Philco Mystery Contest now. Go to your Philco tube dealer and get the free mystery book with the official entry blanks. Read the rules and directions carefully. Follow them exactly. Study the diagram in the case of the dead magician. Then answer the simple question. Your answer may be the winner. Don't miss a single one of the Philco mysteries. Listen every week at this time over this station. Better be sure you have Philco radio tubes in your set, so that reception will be good and clear, and you won't miss a single important detail of any mystery program. You want to win some of that $50,000 in cash, don't you? Then get started. Be a detective. It's fun. Next week, Phil Coe, the girl detective, brings you another swell mystery, The Missing Masterpiece. Listen in at this same time over this same station. Read all about it beforehand in the free Philco Mystery Book. We hope you win.
Well, now that we're into the female detective range, let's bump it up to 1950. This is a series that I don't know if it lasted very long, but there aren't that many episodes of it. I'm sure you've probably heard a few of them anyway. A regional NBC series, Candy Matson, and the phone number, which I can't quite remember, but it was synonymous with the show as well. I like the organ music. The program itself wasn't bad. And she certainly sounded like someone I'd want to meet. Let's just see what female detectives evolved into 14 years after we met Miss Coe.
Hello, Yukon 28209. Yes, this is Candy Matson.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Candy Matson, Yukon 28209. Ladies and gentlemen, before we commence tonight's Candy Matson story, it's a very great pleasure to welcome as our distinguished guest this evening the widely read radio columnist of the San Francisco Examiner, who conducts his own radio column under the title Day and Night with Radio and Television, Mr. Dwight Newton.
Thank you, Dudley Manlove. Recently, I conducted a popularity poll to determine our readers' favorite radio program originating in San Francisco. Heading the list, and a top-heavy favorite, was your Candy Matson program. In behalf of the Examiner readers who participated in the poll, I am happy to present this award, which reads as follows. 1950 San Francisco Examiner Favorite Program Award. This certifies that readers of the San Francisco Examiner have voted Candy Matson their favorite local radio program in a poll conducted by the underside writer of the column Day and Night with Radio and Television. Congratulations to all who participate on the Candy Matson program, to Monty Masters, who writes and directs it, and to you, Natalie Masters, the Candy Matson star.
Thank you, Dwight Newton. We're doubly proud of this award tonight because next week's program will mark Candy Matson's first birthday. From all of us here at NBC in San Francisco, to Dwight Newton, the San Francisco Examiner, and most of all, you, the listeners, who've made this award possible, our very sincere thanks.
We continue now with Candy Matson, Yukon 28209.
Just a moment, I'll be right there. How do you do?
You are Candy Matson, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. And who are you?
Willa Gray.
Come in, won't you, Willa? Is there something I can do for you?
I don't quite know how to explain this, but it's my brother.
Your brother?
Maybe you've heard of him, Miss Matson. Gordon Gray.
Why, sure. The songwriter?
That's right.
Who doesn't know him? He's written almost as many hit songs as Irving Berlin. What about him, Willa?
Well, like many people I know, Gordon is a crime student for relaxation. He reads all the books, listens to all the radio programs, and naturally he's heard and read a great deal about you.
Well, I'm flattered.
When I suggested talking to you, he agreed immediately.
Talking to me, Willa? What about?
Well, it's his mental condition, Miss Matson. He's suddenly become extremely childish. All day long he sits at the piano playing nothing but uncoordinated notes.
Are you sure they're uncoordinated, or is it some new style he's trying to develop?
Miss Matson, you're familiar with Gordon's work. Songs like Lazy Old June, The Tenderness of You. What he's doing now is just musical gibberish.
How well I remember Lazy Old June. I was just a kid in high school at the time. Are you living with your brother, Willa?
No, I'm not. Just as well, too. I don't think I could take it.
Why do you say that?
These foolish notes he plays. He says he's working on a thing to be called Symphony of Death. That someone is going to kill him.
What? Now you've got me interested.
I hope so, Miss Matson. He won't talk to me. Every time I drop by, Gordon just sits at the piano, laughing horribly, and playing these kindergarten notes. As I said, he's a great fan of yours. Won't you go and just speak to my brother?
Sure, I'll see him. Gordon Gray with a shattered mind. What a pity, if true. Think of all the jukeboxes that would have to settle for promissory notes.
Candy Matson, San Francisco's well-known gal private investigator, merely trying to get her penthouse on Telegraph Hill cleaned, and she walks into a stack of memories. Memories created by a songwriter named Gordon Gray. Symphony of Death. It never became a popular composition, but it will always be on Candy's all-time hit parade, a tune she'll never forget, because it brought about a very strange chain of events and a fascinating finish to the entire story. Oh, and the in-between department? Well, here she is, the gal who never suffers from gaffosis, Candy Matson.
When I went into the cold, hard world to make a living for myself, Gordon Gray was an American institution. That's when he wrote his never-to-be-forgotten The Rhapsody of You. I'd had no idea that Gray was in San Francisco. The last I'd heard, he was in New York, working on the score of a brand-new musical. So when his sister confronted me like that, naturally, I was caught a bit off base. She wrote Gordon's address for me, and like the rabbity little elf she seemed, ducked out as abruptly as she came. Then I dressed, drove over to an apartment house on Powell Street, just down from the family club. I pressed the button. It blew an ugly little noise back at me. I entered, went up the stairs to 221. The door opened.
Yeah?
Mr. Gray?
Yes, that's right.
I didn't call you on the phone. I thought I'd just more or less barge in on you. I'm Candy Matson.
Candy Matson. Do come in. Oh, please do come in.
Thank you.
So, my little sister finally got up enough gumption to call you.
Yes, she came by this afternoon. We had quite a nice little chat.
A nice chat? With my sister? Impossible. A little mouse doesn't know how to put one word after another. Oh, here. Do sit down, won't you? Place is a mess. I've got manuscript all over the floor, the highboy, the whatnot, everywhere. Highball? Spot of sherry?
Thank you, no, not right at the moment.
As you say.
I beg your pardon?
It's nothing, really. I'm just thinking of my monstrous joke. I'm going to be killed, you know.
Yes, so your sister said. Do you mind?
My sister. Young. She's young enough to be my grandchild. Do you know what? She thinks I'm slipping my cable.
Do you mind if I call you Gordon?
I'd love it. Providing I can call you Candy.
I'd despise myself in the AM if you didn't.
Candy, you're just as delightful as I had you pictured.
Thanks, Gordon. Now, frankly, what do you think? Are you slipping your cable?
Of all the idiotic... Of course not.
Willa seems convinced you are.
Willa's a mere babe, a suckling.
What about this new thing you're working on, Gordon? This symphony of death?
She told you about that, too, huh? That's part of my monstrous joke, Candy.
Want to confide in me? Let me know what this joke is?
I don't mind in the least. You have brains. Not many people have brains in this world, Candy. But you do. And because you have brains, I'm going to give you a challenge.
Okay, let me have it.
Oh, no. The challenge will only come after he kills me.
He? Who are you referring to, Gordon?
That's part of the challenge, Candy.
I see. Do you really believe that someone's out to kill you?
But of course. That's the delicious part of the whole thing. I'm going to be killed. It can't be avoided. That's why I'm writing my symphony of death.
Oh, sure. Now I see.
You're making fun of me, Candy.
No, I'm not, Gordon, really. It's just that, well, I've never met anyone who was happy about the prospect of getting knocked off.
I don't mind, actually. I've lived a full life. I've seen the world, made lots of money, been wined and dined by people in all walks of life. My music will live after me. That's all I care about.
Now I can understand.
There. You see, that's why I like you. You have brains. Shall I play my new composition for you?
If you like.
Very well. As you will discover after I'm dead. It's all part of my monstrous joke. Excuse me. Pay no attention to the technique, Candy, my dear. My fingers aren't quite as supple as they used to be. There. What do you think of it?
Gordon, I think it's a great, monstrous joke.
I knew you'd see it. It's part of the joke. You're really sharp. I knew it. That's part of the joke, and you can see it.
You pay wonderful compliments, Gordon. Thank you. But don't you think this symphony of death is a complete departure from your usual style? From something like, well, the Rhapsody of You, for instance?
Certainly. It's because of him. I had to write something dedicated to him, didn't I?
Well, to scramble a dangling participle, who's him?
The man who's going to kill me.
As I left, I tried to shake the picture of a cackling man playing one-fingered doodles on the keyboard, but I couldn't. The impression was indelible. When I arrived home, I was greeted by the sight of a familiar auto parked out in front. It was my number one boy, Inspector Ray Mellard of San Francisco Homicide. I invited him up to sit a spell and chew the fat.
What's new, Cupcake? I haven't seen you for several days. Seems like weeks.
Ha! Huh, a compliment. That means you're after something.
I am not. Can't I ever say something nice without you misconstruing?
Oh, okay. Compliment accepted. Good. What brings you around here this time of day, Mellard, dear? Aren't you on duty?
That's the trouble. I've been on duty for almost 48 hours straight. I had to take a little breather for myself.
Working on a deal?
Yeah, a hot one. No leads, no clues, no nothing.
For a slight consideration, I might be inclined to help you crack the case, Sherlock.
By the way, what are you working on?
Nothing but hope and what's left of the bank account.
You mean to say the great lady Private Eye is temporarily at liberty?
I mean to say just exactly that.
Well, if I'm any judge of your business ability, you've got enough money tucked away to buy the Philadelphia Athletics from Connie Mack. What do you do with all your loot, Candy?
Throw it in hair mattresses and sleep on it. Oh, excuse me a moment, Mellie.
Sure, go right ahead.
Oh, hello, Willa. I didn't expect to see you so soon.
I hope you won't think me a nuisance, but I just had to see
you. I understand. Come in.
No, thanks. You've been to see Gordon. I just spoke with him on the phone and he told me.
Yes, that's right.
What do you think, Miss Matson?
Very sad, Willa. How long has he been like this?
Just a week or so. He flew in from New York and I could see the change in him right away.
How long ago did he leave for New York?
He left Hollywood for New York last month.
Was he all right then?
Oh, yes, just fine. He seemed so happy. He just finished writing the music for the new show in the East. But when he got there, the backers, as they say in show business, told him the music was no good. He said he'd return to the coast and redo it. But instead of going back to Hollywood, he came here. Took that apartment on Powell Street, and he's been holed up there ever since.
Do you think being told his music was no good had anything to do with his present condition?
Oh, I'm sure of it, Miss Matson. He's always been such a sensitive person.
No, no, Willa. I've known several people who snapped momentarily under a terrific strain. Maybe it's not as serious as you think.
But what am I going to do?
Well, first, he needs aid. Immediately. I know a Judge Conway here in town. I think he'll help you get Gordon committed to a sanitarium where he'll get the finest medical aid available.
A sanitarium? Oh, no, Miss Matson, that would kill Gordon.
It's either that or have him get progressively worse.
I suppose you're right. Could you, I mean, would you talk to Gordon? Explain what must be done? I don't think I'm capable.
Sure, I'll do it, Willa. You sit tight and I'll call you just as soon as I speak with Judge Conway.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I imagine I should inquire as to how much you charge for your services.
No, forget it, Willa. Getting Gordon Gray back to normal will be pay enough.
You're just wonderful, Miss Matson. Goodbye.
Poor kid. So helpless.
Poor kid is right. I couldn't help overhearing. She's about 90% mouse.
She and Gordon must have been poured right out of the same mold as far as sensitivity is concerned.
Is that the Gordon Gray, Candy? The famous songwriter?
That's the one.
And he's cracked up?
Mm-hmm.
Downright sure. Well, thanks, pal. Just the sight of you has picked me up considerably. I'll be getting back to the grind.
Mellie, dear, hold me tight for just a moment, will you?
Sure. Don't let Gordon Gray get you down a cupcake.
Well, it wasn't a very pretty sight. And I've got to face him again. Thanks for the hug, Mellard. I'll return it someday. Mellard released his grip and left. I snapped my ribs back in place and steeled myself for the ordeal ahead of me. It wasn't going to be easy, but it had to be done. So once again, I found myself ducking down Green Street, over Powell, across California, and down the roller coaster of a hill to Gordon's apartment. He answered the door, and I was met with just as much enthusiasm as before.
Candy Matson, I was wondering where you'd been. You've been gone for ages, darling. Do come in. I've got a surprise for you. When did you get back from Europe?
When did I get back? Oh, just a day or so ago.
Your letters were wonderful. I especially adored the one from Naples. What a time you must have had.
Yes. Yes, quite a time, Gordon. How's the new symphony coming along?
That's the surprise, my dear. It's completed. Long last, it's finished. To be perfectly frank, Candy, I think it's great. I've been in touch with Toscanini. He's going to give it its premiere performance at Carnegie next month. I've already sent him the revised manuscript. Can you picture it, Candy? A hushed crowd. Maestro wraps his baton. The orchestra comes to full attention. Then that magnificent, firm downbeat of Toscanini's and Symphony of Death is making its debut. First, the Allegretto. Then the Molto Andante. The audience is at first inclined to scoff, to think that Gordon Gray could write serious music
From lazy old June to Symphony of Death. Too much of a step, they'd say. Then Toscanini glides into the con moto. The audience tenses, not believing their ears. Little by little, they understand what Gordon Gray is trying to express. Then, as if it were not enough, Toscanini moves into the breathtaking finale. It soars, it moves. It transports everyone in Carnegie Hall into another world. And abruptly, Symphony of Death. The Symphony of Death is over. The audience arises as one. They shout for Gordon Gray, the composer. History's being made. More shots for the composer. But Gordon Gray isn't there. Gordon Gray's dead. Because of him.
Gordon, listen to me.
Because of him. The world will have to be denied any further music from the pen of Gordon Gray.
I said listen to me, Gordon.
Hmm? Oh. Go on.
I want to talk to you. And you've got to listen very carefully. You're sick. You need help. Your sister and I are arranging to have you sent to a home nearby. They'll have you on your feet in short order.
Sent away?
Yes.
That means he will visit me sooner than I had planned. Very well, Candy. Tell Willa to do whatever she thinks best. I won't give her any trouble.
It's for your own good, Gordon. Believe me.
I know. Candy, you never went to Europe, did you? You were here earlier this afternoon. Isn't that right?
That's right.
You just went along with the gag.
That's right, Gordon.
Yeah. You'll be here sooner. Much sooner than I expected.
Gordon Gray went into the other room and lay down on his studio couch, face down. That's when I tiptoed out of the apartment. If only I could have peeked into the future, I'd never have left, because that was the last time Gordon Gray was seen alive. I went home, fixed myself something to eat, turned the radio on low, and sat down with a book called That Frail Vessel, a book about the behavior of the human mind. Out of one corner of my ear, I heard it. It was the 10 o'clock news over NBC with Sam Hayes. And there it was. The body of Gordon Gray had been found in his apartment. The book clattered out of my hands and I sat there for a moment stunned. But only for a moment. Another second I was driving over to pick up an old pal of mine, Rembrandt Watson. There was a good reason for it. Rembrandt studying to play the cello. On the way over I noticed the headlines. The police had the net out for Gordon's sister, Willa. Rembrandt was home. He was agreeable to going to Gordon Gray's apartment with me. And before you could bat an eyelash, providing your batting average was good, we were in said apartment alone.
My word, girl. What a garish-looking place.
It didn't belong to Gordon personally, Rembrandt. He was merely renting it.
He still doesn't deny the fact that it's garish. Can't be the truth now. Why did you want me to come to this Victorian mausoleum with you?
Just a hunch, Ducky. Are you still taking cello lessons?
Taking them? Girl, don't be ridiculous. I'm now giving them.
Even better. Just as I thought. The boys in blue haven't touched anything. The manuscript for Symphony of Death is still on the piano. Can you play single notes on the piano, Rembrandt?
Well, I can try.
Good. Run your hangnails over this.
Strange. This isn't music. Except a series of notes with no meter, phrasing, or regard for the proper time to the bar.
Exactly. Play it just the way it's written.
Very well.
And call out the notes as you go along. I think I'm beginning to understand Gordon's Symphony of Death.
As you say, B, A, D, and for no reason at all, there's a rest, Candy.
B, A, D, and a rest. Go ahead.
E, G, G, and another rest.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes D, E, A, D. A long gap in the manuscript.
You know what that spells musically, Ducky? Bad egg dead.
Utter confusion.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't think so. As we say in the movies, continue on.
F, A, G, G, E, D. No timing at all.
That spells fagged.
So am I. However, it goes on like this. D, E, A, F.
another rest, then B, E, E. Fini.
What?
Through. It's kaput. Finished.
Let's see now. Bad egg, dead. Fagged. Deaf. B.
Candy, love. If you're going to the notes of the musical scale, you could spell practically anything out of A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, even from a tune like Ragmuffin.
But this means something. I know it does. Gordon told me it was going to be a challenge. What? Who's there?
Don't be alarmed, Miss Matson. It's only me, Willa.
Willa, how did you get in here? Don't you know the police are looking all over town for you?
Let them look. I don't care. My brother's dead. I read it in the papers.
How did you get in here, Willa? The cops are surrounding the place.
I just walked in through the front door.
Oh, wait till Mallard hears about this. Willa, you didn't kill Gordon, did you?
No, Miss Matson, I didn't. Honestly, I didn't.
I believe you, Willa. Because I think I know who did kill your brother.
You do? Tell me. Oh, please, tell me.
Down at the Hall of Justice. Okay, let's go. Oh, Rembrandt. Bring along that bust of Beethoven sitting on the piano, will you?
Pleasure, dear. I'll be glad to. Candy, this thing must weigh at least 15 pounds.
Well, you're the only man in the group.
Oh? Oh. Very well. Come along, bust. Hall of Justice or likewise.
Candy, what are you doing here at a time like this? Can't you see I'm busy?
Sure, I only want to see you busier. This is Willa Gray, remember her?
Just the girl we're looking
for. Well, save your breath, Mallard. Willa's innocent. She had nothing to do with Gordon Gray's death.
Okay, you know so much. Who in tarnation did?
Put that bust of Beethoven on Mallard's desk, Rembrandt.
I was wondering how long I'd have to hold this thing.
What in the name of Schenectady do I want with that?
There sits your murderer.
Candy, are you out of your head?
No, it's so complex it's simple, Mallard. Gordon Gray works like a beaver for 2 months writing a musical score for a new Broadway show. He takes the score to New York. The producers tell him it's no good. It's the first time it's ever happened to Gordon. It does something to his mind. He broods. He comes to San Francisco. His mental condition becomes worse.
So is yours.
Where you're concerned, yes. But let me finish. Here, take a look at this.
Bad, egg, dead. Fag. Deaf, D. Okay, I give up. What does it mean?
Bad, egg, dead. Gordon Gray is referring to himself. Fag, that means he had come to the end of his rope. His musical knowledge and creative ability were running dry. Gray had nothing more to live for.
Okay, Miss Edgar Allan Poe. What does deaf D mean?
Well, that had me stumped for a while, too. Then I got to looking at this bust of Beethoven standing on the piano. It seemed to dominate the entire room. Then I put two and two together and got Ludwig von Beethoven. B was an abbreviation of Beethoven. Beethoven was deaf. Deaf B.
I don't get it.
You will. Beethoven is going to hit an all-time low. The answer lies inside that plaster bust, I'm sure. Stand back, Mallard. I'm about to splatter a genius. Take a look.
Good gravy. A small fortune in greenbacks.
That's right. And a note, too, if these eyes don't deceive me. Congratulations, whoever you might be. You learned the true meaning of my symphony of death. You've also just executed my killer, von Beethoven. Now perhaps he knows how it feels to be cracked up, too. Thanks for participating in my little joke, my last charade. This is my entire estate. Put it to whatever good use you may see fit. Gordon Gray. Oh, Rembrandt, do me a favor. Take Willa outside. The poor kid's pretty badly shot.
Certainly, Doug. Come along, young lady.
I still don't get it, Candy.
That's easy to fill in the gaps now, Mallard. Gordon's music was falling apart. He knew it. So he started swiping melodies from obscure Beethoven themes. But Gordon, with only his flair for writing popular music, couldn't grasp what Beethoven had originally intended. Consequently, the things he wrote were terrible. The more he copied, the more he realized that Beethoven was becoming an all-ruling obsession. It was Beethoven in the morning, Beethoven at night, Beethoven 24 hours a day until it drove Gordon completely out of his mind.
That I can understand, but what's this joke he mentioned?
Well, he was a great mystery fan. That's why he wrote this gibberish thing called Symphony of Death. A group of notes that spelled out bad egg dead, fagged, death bee, and so on. All part of his warped mental condition.
Well, that makes sense. Except for one thing. How did Gordon Gray die? Exactly when he wanted to die.
Mallard, dear, I now know there are some mighty strange things in this world. Even a completely sick mind such as Gordon's has great powers of concentration. Gordon was like a captain without a ship. Like a man who's been married 50 years who suddenly has no wife. You probably won't believe it, Mallard, but Gordon Gray, knowing that his mind was shot, and knowing, too, that every last bar of creative music had been drained from his heart, his soul, willed himself to die. Fantastic? Not necessarily so. There are many stories about animals who have done the same thing. If animals can do it, why can't a human being with a so-called higher plane of intelligence do it, too? So that's what Gordon had done. Taken his life savings, sealed them into a plaster bust of Beethoven, along with his last laugh note, and sat himself down to die. In Gordon's mind, Beethoven had killed him. I can understand why, too. For just before we left his apartment, I found another manuscript. I had Rembrandt run over it. Note for note, it was the Moonlight Sonata, backwards. But in one respect, Gordon had outscored the old masters. He had completed his symphony of death, and Beethoven was in little pieces. That left him one up on another old master, a fellow named Franz Schubert. He'd left one entirely unfinished.
The characters in tonight's story are entirely fictitious. Any resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. Actors heard this evening were Phyllis Skelton as Willa Gray, John Grover was her brother, Gordon Gray, Jack Thomas as Rembrandt Watson, and Henry Leff as Inspector Ray Mallard. From the star of our program, Natalie Masters, and from her husband, Monty Masters, who writes and directs Candy Matson, and from the staff of the National Broadcasting Company, we wish to express our deep thanks and sincere appreciation to the San Francisco Examiner and Dwight Newton, radio columnist of the Examiner, for tonight's presentation, naming Candy Matson as the number one program in the San Francisco metropolitan Bay Area. Listen again next week at the same time for excitement and adventure. Just dial
Candy Matson, Yukon 28209.
The program came to you from San Francisco. Dudley Manlove speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
A little time left over, I'm going to go back to one of the many series that I know nothing about, and I don't know how much is written about it. I don't have my John Dunning book handy to be sure, but this is one of those syndicated shows that were good for fillers. Captains of Industry. I'm not sure when it was from. To me, it sounds like the late 30s, and they highlighted the probably semi-fictional, but perhaps factual, biographies of some of the U.S. most important industrialists. And I thought we'd sort of end the night in a kind of a sweet way, and we'll talk about good old Hershey. I'm sure most of us have explored that product, and here's the guy who made it.
The story of Milton Hershey, known to millions as the Chocolate King, first saw light of day in the pleasant little village of Dairy Church, Pennsylvania, during September of the year 1857. He first became acquainted with the art of candy making as a Lancaster. For 2 years, young Milton applied himself to manufacturing tasty and wholesome candies. Then, at the age of 19, he decided he had learned all there was to learn as a candy maker's helper and resigned his position. He had saved a small amount of money and forthwith conceived the idea of going into business for himself. His family promptly squelched this notion as impractical and silly. His father, a rugged Pennsylvania farmer, had different plans for his son, so Milton tilled and plowed on the farm. Then one evening, leaving the family farm quietly, he tramped 7 miles to a neighboring farm.
Why, Milton, it's you.
Yes, Aunt Frieda. May I come in?
Of course, dear. How's everybody at your place?
Oh, fine, thanks. Father's pretty busy getting in the new crop. Say, Aunt Frieda.
Anything wrong, Milton?
Well, you know I'm not very happy on the farm, and, well, I almost wish now I hadn't given up my job in Lancaster. The money I'd saved is all gone in the farm.
Well, what of it? The farm will be yours someday.
But I don't want to be a farmer. Aunt Frieda, did you know that I can make a better caramel than anyone is making today?
Oh, Milton boy. As if caramels were important.
Well, they would be if I could make enough to sell.
Oh.
I made some tonight. Here, try one.
Oh, no, no, no.
Go on, try it. Go on.
I don't want...
Go on.
Well, just one then.
Here.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
There. Aren't they good?
Mm, delicious. You must tell me how to make them.
Well, I will, Aunt Frieda. Well, that is, if you'll do me a favor.
Yes, what?
Lend me enough money to go back to the city.
Oh, what on earth for?
To set up a candy business for myself. It'll make money. I know it will.
Oh, dear me, I never heard of such a thing. Well, how much will it take?
Only $100 at the very most.
Oh, Milton, I don't know. We'll have to think it over very carefully.
Here, have another caramel.
It could have been the deliciousness of the sweetmeats that persuaded Aunt Frieda finally to lend young Milton enough capital to venture forth on his new enterprise. At any rate, she did have faith in the boy. We next meet Milton some months later in Philadelphia, where he rented a room which he turned into a kitchen. He invested quite a few dollars in flavorings, kettles, and pots, and set himself up as a candy manufacturer. With the remainder of his money, he acquired an old spavined horse and a huge, cumbersome five-wheeled wagon. Over the cobblestone streets he rode, selling his wares.
Fresh, delicious candy. Fresh, delicious candy.
Oh, boy.
Whoa, Nellie. We have a customer. Good afternoon, ma'am.
What kind of candy have you got?
Oh, all kinds. Peppermints, caramels, chocolates, and they're all nice and fresh, too.
But who makes them?
I do.
Hmm. Well, they can't be very good.
Oh, yes, they are. Here, try a sample of, whatever you like.
Well... I'll try one of these. Well, that's not bad. Well, how much is it for a bag of these?
5 cents. Whoa, Nellie, whoa.
Well, what's the matter with your horse?
I don't know. She's been acting up all day. Whoa, girl, whoa. Would you like a bag of these?
Well, I guess I don't like the way that horse is acting.
Whoa.
Look,
whoa, Nellie.
Look out, he's trying to run away.
I wonder he wasn't killed.
I certainly took a spill. Why, the horse broke loose and went right on down the street.
Goodness, are you all right, young man?
Well, I think so.
Dear me, just look at that. Your candy all over the street.
Yes. Quite a mess, isn't it? Oh, here, I saved your bag of candy if you still want it.
So ended Milton Hershey's first independent business venture disastrously as the clumsy five-wheeled cart upset over the rough cobblestones of Philadelphia streets. Abashed, Milton sold his few possessions and decided to return to the farm with a debt to his Aunt Frieda staring him in the face. However, it wasn't long until he had settled that score by peddling his candies to the neighbors and small surrounding towns. A few years later, Milton set up in business again, this time in Lancaster. From the day he opened the doors of his little shop, success seemed to flow to him in an unending stream. Hershey's Crystal A caramels were almost as well known as are those familiar foil-wrapped bars today. In May of 1898, the charming and beautiful Catherine Sweeney became Mrs. Milton Hershey. Only after success had come would he ask her to share his life. Then, early in 1901, while the shadows of big business were being cast, a group of prominent candy manufacturers called on Mr. Hershey in his Lancaster offices. Mr. Durand, spokesman for the committee, presents their case.
Mr. Hershey, the companies these gentlemen represent, as well as my own, are all merging. Now, needless to say, a merger without Hershey's Crystal Lake Caramels...
I see. You want me to merge my company with yours?
That's it, exactly.
Yes, indeed. Yes, that's what we have...
Well, gentlemen, I feel flattered, but I regret the answer is no.
No? But look here, Hershey. This would mean sharing in the profits of the other five companies.
Durant, I'm not interested in more profits. I'm comfortable and happy running my business as I see fit.
But what man would turn down another $30,000 or $40,000 a year?
Milton Hershey.
Well, Durand, I guess the merger's off.
I'm afraid so.
Don't know.
Just a moment, boys. Mr. Hershey, would you consider selling your business to us outright?
Well,
I'd say unofficially, of course. It would be worth about $500,000 to us.
Really, Durand,
I may be talking out of turn, but I feel if we don't get Hershey, we're all through. Personally, I think this deal is worth at least $1,000,000.
$1,000,000?
What do the rest of you have to say to that?
I agree. I would approve of it. Gentlemen, you rather take me off my feet.
I think $1,000,000 would.
Gentlemen, before I can give you my final answer, I must talk this over with my wife.
Catherine Hershey approved, and so Milton Hershey retired. With $1,000,000 to his credit, they set forth on what was to be a 2 years' journey to every corner of the globe. A few weeks later, they were in a luxurious hotel in Mexico City. Sitting alone on the balcony of their suite, they were listening to an orchestra playing in the patio below.
Well, Milton, how do you like Mexico now?
Well, not half so well as Lancaster County, my dear.
Oh, really?
Catherine, I've been doing a lot of thinking since we left home. You know, when a man gets wealthy, he either gets very selfish or his money worries him. Now that I've made our money, I have no desire to make more. But I have an idea I'd like to carry out.
And what is your idea, Milton?
I'd like to manufacture a superlative milk chocolate in a plant where conditions would be as fine and wholesome as the product. Not as a money-making venture, Catherine, but for two things. To occupy my time and to make it possible for men and women to work and live in comfortable, happy surroundings.
Milton, you're really anxious to get back into business?
I mean it with all my heart, my dear. Well, what's your answer?
I want you to be happy, Milton. So my answer is, let's pack up now. I'm lonesome for home, too.
Returning home, Milton Hershey decided to build his chocolate plant on the same ground where, as a boy, he had gone to school. However, he was not content to build just a factory. He built a model factory, spotless and gleaming, with recreation, rest, and dining rooms for his workers and small, neat homes which they could rent at a nominal cost. Thus started the now famous town of Hershey, Pennsylvania. And then Hershey plunged into great philanthropies, schools, libraries, community buildings, but in particular, additional attention to a boys' industrial school he had founded. Then came an evening when he invited to dinner all the executives of his various enterprises.
And now, if I may have your attention for a moment. I want each of you to look under your place cards and see what you find.
Why, Milton, what is all this? This piece of paper says good for one life membership in the Hershey Country Club. Well, where is this club?
Well, Lou, the club happens to be this very house.
This house?
Oh, thanks.
What do you mean? You're going to give us this house for a country club?
Exactly. Since Mrs. Hershey's passing, I don't need a home anymore.
But where are you going to live?
Yeah, that's a question.
Oh, I'm a member, too. I shall take a 3-room suite and live here. I'm paying rent for it, too, you know.
Oh, well, boys, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow.
So, Milton Hershey became a paying guest in the home which was once his own. A big user of sugar, he acquired 90,000 acres in Cuba, where, with his usual genius, he created a second town of Hershey, as modern and fine as the first. It is noteworthy to relate that Mr. Hershey was among the first of America's many great industrialists to give back much of his company to the men who worked for him, making them stockholders. One time to a friend, Milton Hershey expressed his views.
Try as he may to avoid it, every human being has a contact, remote though it may be, with every other human being, whether it concerns food, clothing, or other necessities.
All is obtained through the labor of another person. One supplies, the other demands. The truth of the matter is, we're all dependent upon the other. So it seems to me that the world does not owe the individual a living so much as we all owe the world a good and useful life.
And in these words, he expressed his panacea for living, one which he practiced constantly and one which made him an outstanding example to his fellow men. Milton S. Hershey, Captain of Industry.
And that brings us to the end of the line for our first offering for the year. Hey, I've had fun. I've kind of missed being here. I hope you've missed me too, please. And that you'll be back in a few weeks when I'm back. But of course, next week, we have a whole new program, a whole new host, and some good stuff. In the meantime, of course, my thanks for listening. That makes it worthwhile. And also to the gang, Susan, our scheduler, or is it scheduler, depending what country you're coming from, Luis, our interlocutor, Michael and his leadership, Daniel, our executive producer, certainly for my stuff and for most others, and hard down in the bottom corner of Southern Ontario, good old Max, the mad guy. So on behalf of all of them, welcome into this year. We look forward to you next week. And now it's time for that interlocutor to come forward and do what he does best. You've probably got it memorized already, but Luis, your turn.
Say that you love me true. I must be emphatic. Don't think I'm erratic. That wonderful static. Don't give me a headache. Oh, I love those tones, dearest, although they make me feel blue.
Who was that bomb?
I love to listen to my radio. Gee, how it thrills me when I hear it go. Someday you'll hear it
too. Okay, Rick, thanks a lot. You set them up. Now I am going to knock them down. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time again when I must wrap things up and shut things down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But don't worry, we will be back again next week, doing the thing that we do best, and that is hooking you up with the highest quality OTR surprises that are within our powers to produce. Let me thank you for joining us. I know that we have a select few diehard fans that come back every week and give our programs a listen. We just finished 2014. We are now starting up the 2015 broadcast season. And we are hoping that it is a very prosperous, uneventful, successful new year. These things just keep ticking away. 15 years into the 21st century. That says a lot. But anyway, if you have any questions, comments, or complaints, maybe even a request or two, please submit them via email to mikeamelli@earthlink.net. That is MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. Otherwise, Lucky Lou and Rotten Rick might have to just come after you. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, great weekend, and goodbye. Happy New Year, everyone.